Happy one summer. Okay. It is fantastic to be together. And as is tradition now during one summer, we do a sermon series. We used to call it From the Pews, or If These Pews Could Talk. And last year we renamed it BIOS, Stories That Shape Us. We thought we were clever. BIOS, biographies, BIOS, life. And we have people in the pews, church members rather than pastors, who share stories of deep transformation, stories that impacted their lives in ways that changed them. And so we spend the summer listening to them. We also feature a pastor, myself, to reflect for a few minutes on the story. For the first 2 years that we've done this, we had the church members share their story, and then the pastor would speak after that and sort of interpret that from a biblical perspective. This year, we're trying something a little bit different. We are wanting to let the church members' story speak richly and deeply. And so as pastors, we will, at the start, open up scripture and share a little bit of what we feel the biblical story speaks into the church member's story. And so that is a little bit of a change, but that's how we do it. So when I'm done, I know when a pastor is done, everybody checks out and they're ready to go home. Please don't do that. I'm going to do a homily, which hopefully is short, and then we will listen to our featured church member for today. Stories that shape us. And as we listen to our first story today, I want to talk for just a little bit as we open up the word into Pastor Vadim's story about faith, and faith that is the story that shapes us. And that is this: we are beloved daughters and sons of God. We, you and I, are beloved daughters and sons of God. And one of the immense spiritual tasks that each of us face is to claim that identity and to live based on that knowledge that we are daughters and sons of God. But this is not easy. Most of us, in fact, often fail to claim the truth of who we are. And so the question you and I are faced with each and every day is, who am I? That is the question that drives our lives. Who am I? Henry Nouwen has pointed out that we can answer this question in three ways. Very often when we ask the question, who am I? The first thing we say is, I am what I do. We lead conversations with strangers usually, hi, who are you? My name is Diva, what do you do? And then we go into our careers or our vocations. I am what I do. And when we are doing good things, we feel good and affirmed. But the problem is if who I am is what I do, when I don't do good and when I fail in what I do, I don't feel good. I feel like a failure. And so the first question of who I am, often we answer it with, I am what I do. The second way in which we answer the question of who I am is, I am what I have. I have kind parents. I have a good education. I have decent health. I have fantastic friends. I also have property or a house and a car. We often define ourselves by what we have. And again, this is all good and not bad, but the problem is, if we define ourselves by only what we have, when these things are gone, we struggle. When our friends disappear, when family passes away, when our health is in jeopardy, we don't feel good anymore. And our identity of what we have crumbles. Who am I? I am what I do. I am what I have. And a third one is, often I am who others say I am. And again, this is such a good thing because very often we speak into our friends and family and even strangers' lives and affirm them with the many good things we see in them. And when people speak well of you, you feel good. But the problem is people don't always speak well of you. I don't know about you, but at least that's my experience. And when people say negative things about you, you feel sad or depressed or not worthy. When I was a youth pastor, I heard someone talk about junior high ministry, and they said, critics' math. And this has always stayed with me. Critics' math is 1,000 compliments plus one criticism equals one criticism. And so, if we define ourselves by who others say I am or we are, that is all good. But this critic's math means that no matter how many times people affirm us and say good things, the one time we're broken down, it tears us apart and ruins our lives. We have so many voices that compete for our attention too, and that is a struggle. One voice says, prove that you are a good person. Another voice says, you should be ashamed of yourself. Another voice says, nobody cares about you. Another voice says, be sure to become successful or popular or powerful. In today's culture of the omnipresence of affirmation, it is even harder when we define ourselves by who others say we are. With Facebook and Instagram and Twitter and all the different social media, we're craving after likes and followers and fans. And when we post a picture, if we have 20 likes on that picture of us eating watermelon, reading books, Chris Singer Kids, if you follow my Facebook feed, we only had 20 likes. I think it's higher than that. Hopefully it can go to 200 likes because I'll feel much better about myself. And we know that this is the way the social world is designed. And that affirmation is good, but we know in some sense it is superficial. And then we put so much energy into I am what I do, or I am what I have, or I am what others say that I am. And in fact, so studies have shown that we feel simultaneously more connected and lonelier than ever before. Why? Because while we may crave affirmation, what we need is acceptance. While we crave affirmation, what we need is acceptance. Affirmation, and not this purpose of trying to fit in, but acceptance, which is someone accepting you for who you are, who you are. And the Bible says we are loved by the good, good Father. In Mark, starts his gospel with this. He starts with the baptism of Jesus. In fact, first on the scene, we get John the Baptist, and then we see John the Baptist says, someone greater than me will come. And this is what it says in chapter 1, verse 9. In those days, Jesus came from Nazareth of Galilee, and he was baptized by John in the Jordan. And just as he was coming up out of the water, he saw the heavens torn apart and the Spirit descending like a dove on him. And a voice came from heaven saying, you are my Son, the Beloved. With you I am well pleased. If you look at the Gospel of Mark, he does not have a birth story. Mark does not concern himself with the physical birth with Jesus, but he starts his gospel with the spiritual birth of Jesus, being born of the Spirit. And the very first thing Mark wants us to know is that Jesus is the Son of God. Jesus is beloved. The first thing that God wants Jesus to know is you are the beloved. And these are words of not only affirmation, but words of acceptance. The blessings of identity and worth and unwavering regard. What you do, what you have, what others say that you are is not what defines you. It is who you are, and you are my beloved daughter and son of God. In fact, I don't have time because this is a short homily to explain all the beautiful scholarly work in this, but you can see there in the yellow, the heavens are torn apart. We often think of baptism as this cute moment up front here, photo and cake and celebrations afterwards, and those things are good. But in Mark, he's immediately going to the water, and the heavens are torn apart. The Greek words here are very dramatic. This is not, here we are. This is tearing apart. In fact, in Mark chapter 15 is the only other time we find this word, when Jesus dies and the temple veil is torn. The separation between God and human beings are forever. It's taken away. So Mark prefigures that in the beginning of his gospel with this dramatic thing. Baptism is dramatic. It is intense. Because guess what? The very next thing, Mark doesn't spend a lot of time in the water, because from the water you go to the wilderness. And then we see Jesus is tempted in the wilderness. As Henry Nouwen again points out, we see that the devil comes to Jesus and he says, "Turn these stones into bread. Define who you are by what you can do, Jesus." And Jesus says, "No, I'm not defined by what I do." Then the devil says, "Okay." He shows him all the kingdoms of the world, and he says, "All the kingdoms of the world are yours if you kneel in front of me. Be defined by what you have, all the kingdoms." And Jesus says, "I'm not defined by what I have." And then the devil tempts him one last time and says, jumps. He takes him to the top of the temple, says, "Jump so the angels can catch you, because scripture says that's what will happen. Because if you do this, then others will talk about you and say that you are the Son of God." And Jesus looks through all of this in the harshness of the wilderness. Baptism is dramatic, and it's quick because it launches Jesus into his career, his vocation, his mission, which is serious, which is intense, which is passionate. And Satan tempts him to say that he is the Son of God by what he does, by what he has, and what others says about him. But Jesus says, "These are lies. I know who I am. I am the beloved Son of God. That is who defines me." And Jesus clung on to this for the rest of his life. People accepted him. People rejected him. People praised him. People crucified him. Yet Jesus clung on through the harshness of the wilderness of life and said, "I am the beloved." Today, as we listen to Pastor Vadim's story, I want you to hear that you are the beloved daughter and son of God. And hear it not only here, but hear it here. So that your whole life can be turned around and listen to what the scripture says about you. "I have loved you with an everlasting love. I have written your name on the palm of my hands. I have knitted you together in your mother's womb. I love you. I embrace you. You are mine, and I am yours, and we belong together." In the harshness of the wilderness of life, if you can hear this voice that speaks to you from all eternity, that you are loved and beloved, no longer will you search for your identity through what you do, what you have, what others say, but you will find it in Jesus. Friends, trust that you are the beloved, that is truly who you are. Our first church member that's going to share his story is Pastor Vadim. You can come up front now, Pastor Vadim. And it happens to be a pastor. It seems like once a summer we have a pastor share their stories. They have stories too, after all. We don't often get to tell our stories. You may have heard a little bit of from Pastor Vadim, but as I think about his story, the Gospel of Mark, and that you are beloved, I feel speaks deeply into his story. And so listen carefully as he shares about his story from the USSR to Riverside.
Thank you, Pastor Dira. I have to admit that I've been stressed about this assignment. It's a little unusual. You can say it had the stress, anxiety had a certain impact on my anatomy. It can be, you know, hair pulling experience. Try to explain, especially describe how it was to be born, to grow, and to live in Russia in former Soviet Union, especially at 11:45 in the morning to a completely sober audience. At least I presumed that. Russia has to be explained sometimes and oftentimes with a little help, and we jump to this. I've shared a little bit about my story. That was born in Odessa, Ukraine. It is now a separate country, used to be part of the former Soviet Union. I was born in 1989, and supposed to be funny. Thank you. Thank you. One person got the joke. 1973, I think a year and a half I already talked about, so I don't want to spend a lot of time. But you can imagine from the very beginning, I was born in the middle of the Cold War as you can possibly get. And my earliest memories were even at school in the kindergarten, we were taught that we have to defend our country, we have to defend our freedom, believe it or not, against a militaristic and dangerous and United States and NATO alliance. So from the very beginning, young men were particularly raised in the spirit of you're supposed to become a defender of your mother, Russia, Rodina Mat. We were taught that we need to learn everything that takes to defend. I remember the propaganda was telling us, and this is actually a few shots that I just took last summer. This one says that this is United States preparing the atomic bomb. This one is, you can see that a NATO alliance in the blue letters. This gentleman appears to be a Western general. He is looking at the mirror. What he sees, a reflection in the mirror? He sees a reflection of Adolf Hitler. So a NATO was compared to this. And this poster kind of says, I want, you can see that letter, and that poster says, I want you. So we were warned about not to become brainwashed by American propaganda. And this is a poster of Kennedy and Khrushchev wrestling. And you know what it says on the top? Anyone read Russian? It says that if you like to blubber with your mouth, you can be easily become a victim of a Western spy. So keep your mouth shut. Don't talk much. And this is the contrast of two pictures. On the top one is two Soviet workers trying to build a better future. And of course, on the bottom, there is a rich businessman and a Western general who are planning another World War III. This is kind of reality of with which we grew up. We were not allowed to receive much information from the West. In fact, one of the things that I was so tempted to begin today is to mention and to quote a little bit from Back to the USSR, which is performed by, or Sting, who said Russians love their children too, which is one of the popular songs. My favorite was by Billy Joel, who wrote this beautiful song called Leningrad. This is the opening lyrics from Leningrad. Victor was born the spring of 44. They never saw his father anymore. The child of sacrifice, the child of war. Another son who never had a father after Leningrad. Went off to school and learned to serve his state. Followed the rules and drank his vodka straight. The only way to live was drown in the hate. The Russian life was very sad, and such was life in Leningrad. The reason I mention you the song, because we could not go to a store and buy the record. What you see right, what do you think you see right now on the screen? This is actually a music record. We called it music on the bones. So if you listen to someone, if you want to listen to Beatles, you want to listen to Sting, or you want to listen to Billy Joel, you have to listen it on the bones. Because this is how Russians figure out they can bootleg records using the X-rays. Use X-rays. They used x-rays and they were recording the records. That's how the Western music, before cassette tapes became available, that's how music was pressed. So it's called Music on the Bones. Today, there's no more country that I was born in. There's no city of Leningrad. I didn't grow up much in consequences of what happened in the 30s and 40s in my country. Actually, I grew up experiencing that because the reality was indeed hard to describe. The harshness, what people had to go through, especially during the Stalin's regime. I just give you a few snippets. My grandma's father went to work one day. He was called to his boss's office and talked to government representatives. He never returned home that day, and his wife and two of his daughters, one of which was my grandma, never saw him again. In that world, it was so easy to obtain what you want. If someone likes your girlfriend or your wife, if someone likes your apartment, if someone likes anything you owe, it was just enough to write an anonymous letter to KGB, it was called NKVD at the time, and they would take that person, and now what you wished for was yours. Millions of people were sent to Siberia, found themselves standing against the brick walls, facing the guns pointing at them on the overcast, frosty Russian mornings. I did not grow up during that time, but I experienced the consequences of the culture that was shaped profoundly. Because generations and generations of people learned to live in fear of the rulers who were so harsh that the Syrian and Babylonian kings would look like Santa Claus as comparing to Stalin's regime. When people were relocated, and not only you were persecuted, or even your entire family would be relocated, especially, again, if they possessed something valuable like a cow, a horse. Entire ethnic groups were moved. Today's conflict that you see on TV, today's conflict between Russia and Ukraine, the conflict that breaks my heart because my mom is a native Russian, my father is from Russia. Who am I? The conflict that you see today mostly was set up to happen because of what happened during Stalin's time and the hatred and animosity that developed between different national groups started back there. You heard a lot the word Crimea. The problem with Crimea was that the native population, Tatars, those who were left on that territory since Genghis Khan, those people had to be moved in hundreds of thousands of people were forced to move to Siberia, ripped off of their motherland, ripped off from the land of their ancestors. Those are the practices of Assyria in Babylon, and that was happening in the 20th century. People lived under this regime, but as soon as it came off, what happened was, when people who used to be motivated only by fear, when they felt that nobody come and arrest them, the people started to realize that now if nothing can happen to me, then I can do pretty much whatever I want. And the harsh reality of corruption came into reality. We were well equipped to defend ourselves militarily. We had a nuclear baseball bat that we can swing anytime we want, and you saw Khrushchev doing this. We also were pretty good in science. We send the man on the moon. We're developing arts and culture. All of those things were used to sort of juxtapose the Soviet or the myth of communists against the Western world. But what you don't see a lot is the talk about the economy, because the economy was completely dismal. By the time I was 13, the people were literally finding no food on the shelves in our grocery stores. Those of you, and we had these conversations with Yami, who comes from Cuba, when it was the same situation back there. Any country that were kind of alive of former Soviet Union, except the ones that were closer to the UK, I think Yugoslavia and Poland were doing a little better. When you come to the store, this is the picture of people. On one side, you see the crowd of people. On the other side, this is the grocery store. You can see the shelves completely empty. And they would get some one little thing and they would be able to sell it. The corruption got to the point when people were expected to pay up or to be paid to do anything. It was just as a regular thing as putting gasoline in the car. Because if there is no state that's going to punish you immediately, then you pretty much do what's needed to survive immediately. People were sort of shamed for wanting to have a better life. This is one of the posters that says that this person has sold his soul for clothes just because he wanted to dress up a little better. And it was kind of looked down. Interestingly enough, that all the elite, the communist elite and their children were quite fashionably dressed. But the rest of the people, 99% of the people, were supposed to suffer, to live the life that was kind of very limited. People, and the paradox was that people loved their country, but they learned, they didn't feel that it belonged to them, so they didn't try to do anything that would actually improve the life in the country. I remember my mom taking me to work, and that describes a working day of a typical Soviet Union worker. So my mom would get to work at 8:30. First thing, what do you need to do when you get to work? You have to have coffee. The coffee grinder was a hand grinder, and you have to grind it for Turkish, which means what? It has to be really, really fine. It has to be in the powder. So it takes a lot of time to grind coffee beans into the powder. So, and of course, after that, you're supposed to enjoy coffee, not in a hurried kind of way. So you get to work at 8:30. By 9:45, you're done with the morning coffee procedure, and you jump straight to work till 10 o'clock. At 10 o'clock, you have to take a mandatory break till 10:15. At 10:15, you return to your desk. But don't be fooled. You don't return to the desk to work. You return to the desk to find a freelance vendors who come and who bring the stuff you cannot buy in the store, in the grocery store, department store. This is where people would buy their meat cuts, ribs, filet mignon. And imagine an engineer sitting in front of the desk, getting the huge projects. My mom worked on the projects, ironically, that developed system of control and automatics for Soviet food industry. So she's developing the system, and someone is bringing the cuts of filet mignon, just pulling out right there and wrapping it in the blueprints of the factories that produce something, but nobody knows what they do. That's where you buy cashew nuts. That's where you buy French perfume, blue jeans, and sneakers. Because it's a quite stressful procedure and there are a lot of cubicles in the room, you have to go one-to-one and you have to give advice on other people. By the time that is done, it's about 11:45, and you jump straight to work till noon, because then you take a mandatory lunch. And at lunch, you have a quick meal, long smoke, and then you have to relax a little and play pool. So you're back by about 1:45. And at 1:45, you jump back to work till 2. Because at 2, you do what? You take a mandatory 15-minute break. from 2:15 to about 16:45. 16 is 4:45. 16:45 you work. And 16:45 you need to start to do what? You need to start to cleaning up your workspace because at 5 you need to clock out. Russians knew that. There are jokes that were circulated among the people. A group of Western economists and managers wanted to do research and compare the Japanese management style and Russian. And they decided to go on an interview. Remember Japan in the late 70s and the 80s? It's the progress like you would not believe. And they wanted to know why would Japan was advancing so much, enriching their people, improving the quality of their people, and Russians. And Russia kind of looked opposite of that. So they went to interview Japanese workers and say, well, describe us, how do you work? Describe us your day. And Japanese worker would say, well, I work 8 hours a day. I work 4 hours for the factory owner. I work 2 hours for Japan, and I work 2 hours for myself. I said, okay, that's interesting. They went and interviewed a Soviet worker. First, they had a hard time to find a sober one. But after they found one, or they believed he was, they asked him to describe his work. And he said, what? What do you mean? So, well, we went to interview a Japanese worker, and he said that he works 8 hours a day, 4 hours for the owner, 2 hours for Japan, and 2 hours for himself. And the Russian said, oh, that's easy. I work about 2 hours a day. And the researcher said, why? What happened? He said, well, it's easy. We don't have any factory owners. And why would I work for Japan? The corruption and also this looseness on every level was breaking down the economy. But the people's life was so harsh that they not only wanted to advance, not doing what they're supposed to do, but trying to find a way to survive. How do you survive? You start playing out stealing stuff. People were stealing almost anything they could. People were bringing and taking home anything they could. People were my neighbor was she worked at the nail factory that they make those plain old nails. She would come home bringing bags and bags of nails every day. I've never seen so much nail. Nails were everywhere. If you work at the cafeteria, you bring home groceries. It was not uncommon to find in a milk store a note that would say to the worker to the next shift saying, please do not water down the milk, we already did it twice. On every possible level, people were bringing anything and they were stealing. Another problem that became apparent in Russia, dealing with the harsh reality that Billy Joel picked up so well, dealing with the stress and trying to deal with the hunger. What is a very good stress reducer and stress reliever that is natural or somewhat? Of course, alcohol and tobacco. Alcoholism and tobacco use. I'm just gonna give you a quick statistic. In the 70s, the average extent of a life of a male in the Soviet Union was in the 40s. In some regions, it was below 40. Men were not supposed to live over 40 years old. Drinking and smoking to suppress the appetite and to deal with stress. People tried to do anything they could. Why am I telling you all of this? Not just to say how bad Russia was, but maybe because my story and the impact what that harsh reality did to me is maybe opposite of what one might expect. Because I think it did me something good. I can tell you stories how people and how many people that I know tried to subvert that harsh reality of the Soviet Union. How people would refuse to take bribes. How doctors would heal the poor kids as well as the rich ones. How people would not turn in their friends to KGB, even knowing that that might be a life threatening for them. I don't remember, I don't know why, but I just don't remember when the first time I met this man. His name was Vladimir Konstantinovich Semyonov. I never called him that. I called him Dedushka Volodya. He was my step-grandfather. My grandma married him when my mom was already an adult. He was a remarkable person. I wasn't his biological child. He had his own grandchildren. But somehow, I find myself spending almost every weekend at my grandma's apartment, and he would spend every hour of that weekend with me, just hanging out. His favorite thing was to buy me a bottle of, do you know what that is? The bottle, I don't know how it was happening, but we actually had Pepsi Cola. It was very hard, of course, you had to have connections, you have to know people to find one. It wasn't easily available, but you could find one. So he would have a little stack for me, and he would love to treat me with a bottle of Pepsi Cola. He showed me the kind of love and acceptance. He became a father figure to me. In many ways, I spent time with him that normally a young man would spend with his father. He taught me everything, and he gave me everything he could. Without expecting anything in return, without expecting anything, any affection in return. He used to say, Vadim, every moment in life counts. But don't live counting down the moments. I don't know what that means. Apparently, you need a shot of vodka to figure that out. But he finished that saying, I love you. This is one of the first, most vivid memories. I remember somebody saying, I love you. I felt to be loved. I was the beloved. We were already living in Texas when my grandfather's, we were in King, Texas, when my grandfather's Volodya's, Dedushka Volodya's health was starting to deteriorate. He was a manager at the huge warehouse at the movie studios. It was his job to manage that space, and everything was under his control, from $100,000 movie cameras to little pins that the wardrobe department used. In the 30 plus years, he never took a paperclip home. I asked him if he would ever take anything. Because in Russia, the saying was, white was accepted to take something, and everyone was doing it, just like in America, you would be speeding on the freeway, they accepted that you would take something. In fact, when you take something, you don't say that you stole it. How you justify what you just did? You say something was poorly placed. And if something is poorly placed, it can easily come into your possession. I ask him, Dedushka Volodya, did you ever have anything that was poorly placed? And he said, yes. I was shocked. He was the man of integrity whom I love, and I was dreading to hear the answer. He said, yes, that was your grandma. Pretty cool, huh? We never talked about it again, but I've learned that integrity is not something you talk about. Integrity is something that you live one moment at a time. Making a phone call in 1996 across the pond was not a cheap thing. It was the time before we had Skype, Viber, or WhatsApp. Today it's free as much as you want. There you have to pay, like, we were paying like $1 a minute to talk. And in 1976, for a student, struggling student in Texas, $1 a minute was a lot of money, so I didn't call often. But one day, one hot, muggy Texas day, I decided I would dial him. His health completely deteriorated. His diabetes took out his eyesight. He couldn't see anymore, but he somehow continued to go to work for a couple of years. He did everything by touch and by memory. My grandma would be just helping him to walk around. He was managing that, but finally he couldn't. He stayed home, and as soon as he started to spend his time at home, his diabetes started to eat him up in a geometrical progression. He was in a lot of pain, and the healthcare was so broken down in the 90s that he couldn't find any help. I asked him, what can I do to help you? His response was, I just like to hear your voice. It is good for me. The sound of my voice was the only price he took for everything he has done for me, for the love he poured on me. I had a lump in my throat the size of a basketball. Completely speechless. A week later, Dedushka Volodya passed away. But I remember our last conversation. How someone can just make someone to feel beloved, that wanting nothing in return but the sound of the voice. When I look of the communion bread, this little morsel that kind of reminds me of my life. And the cup and the sacrifice that someone made for me to be beloved. It wasn't a religious experience for my grandfather. He didn't do it for somehow to fulfill the commandment of the law. He just lived this way, which was quite deeply spiritual and transformative for me, because this was the first tangible experience of love on the background of the society and the culture in which I was born and raised. So there on the phone, I felt like it was the worst day of my life, and it was the best day of my life. There on the phone, I felt like I was back in the Soviet Union. And I felt what it meant to be loved. Because our God does hold the whole world in His hands. We know that, but sometimes we need to be reminded. And I think this table reminds us not only the fact that God does hold the world in His hands, but how He holds it. He holds it in a way that every country, every society, and every soul knows that she or he is beloved. He holds the whole world, from Riverside, California to Odessa, Ukraine, from Tamaria, Texas to Massala, Italy. The whole world is holding its breath. And how many souls today need to hear, and how blessed we are to know that today we have a chance to taste that love and experience that presence, and to know how his hands hold the beloved. And we know it was real back in the USSR, even though we didn't even know what God's love was.